Today's voting day on referendum. It's the ballot initiative that has caught a lot of interest. We were talking about that with Eric Zorn just a minute ago. And I just wanted to mention this. When I was talking to Eric about the voter turnout on this primary day, I mentioned that less than 11% of the people have voted, but that was as of around 9 o'clock in the morning, so we're past noon now. And Eric said the number will surely be larger than that, and I just want to correct the record. Eric is surely right. The number will go up. Won't be 100%, but as they say, they expect the turnout will be relatively low today. 12. I was hoping for something higher than that, Pete. Pete says now we're at 12%. Okay. By the way, 773 texted in to say that they did exactly what John Catanzara said you should do. That is, take a Democratic ballot, regardless of your party, so you can vote, in this person's case, no for the referendum. Well, the referendum's on the Republican and the Democrat ballot. This person also took the Democratic ballot so that they could vote yes for one candidate who only appeared on the Democrat ballot. So if you had a candidate you really liked and they were on the Democrat side, you better vote for them now, because in some of those instances, there just aren't Republicans running. It's 12:13 on WGN. Tom Gimbel joins us, the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Hi, Tom. Welcome back.
Hey, John. How are you?
You all right?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you sound fine. I just didn't like the way you said, hey, John, how are you?
I just actually, usually I'm finishing up lunch. Today I was actually on a business call, so I'm probably still in my CEO mode. I apologize.
Was that CEO Tom Gimbel that I heard there, not radio talent Tom Gimbel?
I don't know who it was. It was probably just like, God, I've got a lot on my plate today, but thank God I voted this morning.
That's what I thought you were getting at. By the way, March Madness is kicking off Thursday, and you guys are doing a tourney party at your place, right?
Every year we open up the tournament with a client event, an employee event, where we have, you know, a dozen TVs going on different games and a hot dog cart and homemade chili cook-off and corned beef for St. Patrick's Day a little late this year, and a few beverages perhaps, and try to embrace the fun of March Madness.
So does your staff work much during the day? Are they kind of in and out of the office cubicles and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I'd say it's probably, you know, we're working till about noon. Party starts around noon. So we get a good half day. And then we kind of leave it to people's discretion. So there's certain people that are like, you know what, I don't have any clients coming, so I'm going to get my work done because I got a crank. Or other people that say, this is my time to spend quality time with clients or prospect or whatsoever, and I'll catch up on my day-to-day work later. So it's really kind of allowing people to use their judgment on how they want to spend their time.
What are your takeaways from that? Does this really boost morale, or do some people roll their eyes? I mean, what do we learn from your experience?
Listen, there's people who hate Christmas and Thanksgiving and the 4th of July. So you can't please everybody all the time. But I think that March Madness and collegiality and a hot dog, unless you're a vegetarian, never hurt anybody. And I think that it's about having fun. I'm a little bit past the overanalyzing if a small group of people don't like fun or happening. It's, you know, you got to do what you think is right when you're a leader. And sometimes everybody likes it, and sometimes some of the people like it. Sometimes you push people through it because you know it's the right thing to do. And
yes,
this is a fun thing that probably it kills a little bit of productivity. There's no doubt about it. But at the same time, it's focusing on long-term morale and collegiality.
And watching the games. I mean, I guess we can do that here at the radio station, but I like the sound of this. It seems to me like if you're into the hoops, you would love to be stealing a glance at the TV. If the boss says that's okay, hooray. Will it be wagering? Do you have an office pool?
We do whatever is legal by the law, John.
I'll leave it at that. Hey, did you see what Bernie Sanders said about a 32-hour work week?
I try not to.
Okay.
I did hear about it. Yeah.
All right, I'm going to ask you about that in a minute. It's kind of what I thought he was going to say. We asked Tom to comment a little bit on the Bernie Sanders proposal we talked about last week. He wants a 32-hour work week without a reduction in pay and without a reduction in benefits. And he points to a study that was done by university researchers in 2022 and the nonprofit 4-Day Week Global, which enlisted 61 companies to reduce working hours for 6 months without cutting wages. Afterward, 71% of the almost 3,000 workers said they were less burned out, and nearly half reported being more satisfied with their jobs. They say productivity does not fall off much either. In fact, one recent study of British companies that agreed to adopt a 32-hour work week concluded that employees came to work less stressed and more focused, while revenues remained steady or increased. Tom Gimbel, what's your reaction to all of that?
I'd say we should compare the British economy to the American economy and the size of the GDP, and I don't think they're very close. And I think that trying to move a cruise ship versus a speedboat is two very different things. And I think that less is not always better any more than more isn't always better. And we have a problem in this country that isn't about how much people work. It's the ability to put forth the effort. And I was just talking to somebody the other day about a 4-day work week that was implemented at a company, and the complaints that they did a 6-month beta. And what ended up happening was Thursdays were extremely stressful.
Huh.
And people still had doctor's appointments and events Monday through Thursday that they needed to leave the office for because everything can't be done on Friday. And so what you end up doing is the people who are paying are getting less and less in return for the dollar, which is basically what inflation is that we're going out and buying hamburgers that are $20 now instead of $10, and now we're going to have companies pay people the same amount and get 75% of the work product and or 80% of the work product. And that doesn't add up. And I think this is one of the challenges that we see in the political climate, is that when either one side has the ability, they always go as far to the right or as far to the left as possible, thinking they have a mandate, and they don't. Hmm. And sometimes compromise is the best solution.
I wonder what a compromise would be then.
A 5-day work week that we already have.
You know, what about, is it 40 hours that is the standard you want to bear, or is it 5 days a week? How would you feel about 4-10s?
It just doesn't work that way because you have exempt and non-exempt, so you have hourly versus salaried, and you have people that want to grow in their career, and then they complain. So if you get somebody, if I've got two people doing the same job, and one's willing to go 50, 60 hours a week, and the other one's 40, and the work products are equal, the person who's doing 50% more work is going to get promoted. Who wants to stop that from happening? The one who only wants to work 40. But why should the one who's working 50 or 60 get penalized because they want to go faster and make more money?
Would you care if, in fact, the productivity were the same, or how would you find
it? You can't.
What do you mean you can't? What are you talking
about? If we're both driving a car, John, and I drive the car for an extra 2 hours and we're going the same speed limit, who goes farther?
I don't think that's an apt analogy, Tom.
Why not?
Because it's not.
Are we going to tell somebody? Here's what people don't get, is that the person who only wants to work 40 hours a week is telling the person that wants to work more, you can't.
Okay, I understand that. But if I may, I think that's your problem. Not your problem, but your problem with it. You don't like being told. And all I'm saying is it possible that the productivity is the same when people work in a more focused way, fewer hours a week? Why would you care then? You're trying to just...
I wouldn't. But the difference is what happens to the... Here's just how it lays out, and I've done some experiments in this, so I speak from a factual perspective, is that you're going to get somebody who's going to say, I'm going to work 5 days a week, and then who's going to get promoted, assuming their output's the same? the person who's working 20% more because they're putting out more work product. Who's going to complain? The person who's only working 4 days a week and only doing 40 hours a week, because they're going to say, I'm doing what I should be. They're just doing extra. Why shouldn't I get promoted?
Well,
that's what we're creating. We're creating a level. We're creating a curve. We're creating a grade scale and a curve. We're not rewarding desire, passion, effort. We're rewarding people that are regressing to the mean. I just wonder why this country that was built on an entrepreneurial spirit, that was built on capitalism, that's the greatest power the world's ever seen, that's done all these things, that has more immigrants wanting to come to this country than any other country in the world, more than Sweden and Canada and Australia. They want to come to America, and we want to change how we do things. I'm baffled by it.
I think that's a good point. But remember, it's a socialist that put this forward, and remember that the Congress hasn't passed it. But we did make it 48 and then 40 hours once upon a time. So I suppose anything is possible. And the thing that I just don't understand, Tom, is if you're working in an assembly line, it doesn't matter how hard I work. It's an assembly line. There's going to be fixed results as a result at a shop. I don't know how those businesses can generate as much revenue. It would have to hurt some kinds of businesses.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you also have the problem of if one company's open at a certain day that another company's closed and following up. It's you need everybody to be in sync. I'm a pro climate guy, but just to give you an analogy, it's like if China and India and everybody else isn't on board with changing the climate, what we're doing in our country, the world's still going to hell in a handbasket if the emission standards aren't global. And it's the same thing. If everybody's not running it the exact same way and the country isn't doing it, you're going to lose out on business and opportunity because some other company or some other salesperson or some other marketing person or whomever is working that extra day.
815 texted in to say, strongly disagree with Tom. He doesn't understand the worker side. 773 said, love Tom. He's so knowledgeable, and you have no answer or evidence for your lazy socialist side. Okay, there's the love him and hate him of you and me, Tom.
Well, I think we know which one of those texters was the smart one, John.
Hey, have a great Super Bowl. Have a great March Madness party on Thursday, my friend.
Hope to see you Thursday, and stay healthy and stay hydrated.
Yeah, I got the invite. Thank you. Thanks to Tom Gimbel. Interesting conversation about Bernie Sanders' hope that America will go from a 40 to a 32-hour work week. Lots of texts. 708 said the CEO always wants free work. He thinks if you work 60 hours a week, you're a better worker. The person working 60 hours getting paid for 40 is a sucker. 815 said the 32-hour work week exemplifies the practice of rewarding mediocrity. 847 said, Tom Gimbel is absolutely right. 224, I work a 40-hour, 4-day week, and it's great. Someone wants to work more hours, they can, but I think they're stupid. We have no loss of output. 815, if their work product is the same, I would think you would rather have the person who can get the job done in 32 hours as opposed to one who takes 40 to do the same job. We'll continue to follow that story. No mention of how likely that is to become law. It's an idea from Bernie Sanders. We've been talking about it this week. Jared Dillian joins us now, the best-selling financial author. He's got a new book out, No Worries, How to Live a Stress-Free Financial Life. Jared, welcome back to the show. We missed you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You were busy writing your book, huh?
Yeah, I'm actually, the next book's coming out in November, so working hard.
I like the introduction. You talk about your childhood, and you grew up lower middle class, those were your words, close enough almost to get a free lunch, no extravagances, the coat you had as a child you had for years, and I think it's just the beginning introduction to remind people that your good fortune did not come because you were born into it, but because you managed to accumulate it, how to preserve it.
Yeah, it's funny because, I really, I didn't set out to make a lot of money initially. You know, when I was in high school, my ambition was to become a Coast Guard officer and work for 20 years and retire and get a pension. I wasn't very ambitious. I did go to the Coast Guard Academy, and I spent 5 years on active duty in the Coast Guard. And while I was on active duty, I began to get interested in investing and read a lot of books and got accepted to grad school, got my MBA at the University of San Francisco, and ended up going to Lehman Brothers. And that's, you know, I only spent 7 years on Wall Street, nine if you count the couple of years that I was on the floor of the Pecos. But that experience gave me really the entrepreneurial ability to do lots of different things in my life. And, you know, I made some money while I was on Wall Street, but I actually made most of it afterwards.
What do you mean afterwards?
Well, when I started my business, when I started my newsletter business, the Daily Dirt Nap. So I've been doing that for the last 16 years, and that's been a very successful business. And I actually ended up doing better on that than if I had stayed on Wall Street.
The book is titled No Worries, How to Live a Stress-Free Financial Life. In order to do so, I presume first you got to get some money, right?
Yeah, and you know, the first part of the book really talks about attitudes towards money. And most personal finance books don't really talk about the idea that you can actually make more money. And it doesn't really occur to people. Like a lot of people, they have a job, they make $60,000 a year, and they think, I make what I make, and that's really it. But there's, you know, there's 24 hours in the day, and you're spending 8 of it working and 8 of it sleeping. So there's 8 hours that you can do stuff with. And there's all sorts of different things that you can do to make more money if it's a priority for you.
So that's, that's what you mean by attitude, I presume.
Yeah, that's what I mean by attitude. Like, instead of thinking in terms of, you know, I have this pie and I'm going to slice this pie into smaller and smaller pieces, I want to get people to think in terms of, well, let's go make some more pie,
yeah.
Right? It's about the difference between living in a scarcity mentality versus an abundance mentality.
I suppose if someone says, no, I like the pie the way it is, that's okay?
Yeah, it's okay, but it's a choice, right? And one of the things I say in the book is, you know, we all choose how much money we have, which is really uncomfortable concept for people to think about. But how much money you make is a choice. How much money I make is a choice. We all get to choose. You know, there's things I could do to make more money, and I haven't done them yet because either I didn't want to put in the work or I didn't want to take the risk or I was comfortable doing what I'm doing. And so I'm choosing how much money I make, and everybody does that.
So if I have the right attitude, though, and do want more pie, okay, now I'm going to go after that. I'll work a second job. You have recommendations like that. Then you talk about balance. What are you talking about there?
Well, we have sort of this mythological person in the United States who has a 580 credit score, and they have a $100,000 truck, and their car payment is bigger than their house payment. And it's this person that we say, this person overspends and goes into debt, and this is what America is like. America is full of people who max out their credit card bills and go into debt. But the reality is that person, the person who spends too much, is actually pretty rare. They're rarer than we're led to believe. You know, most people in the United States are actually pretty good with money. And a lot of people have the opposite problem. They have the problem where they spend too little, right? They're excessively cheap. So instead of being too cheap or too spendthrift, you want to be in the middle. You want to have a healthy relationship with money. That is the goal, is to have a healthy relationship with money.
We're running short of time, but what would you have people spend money on? They're too cheap. They're not spending money on what should they be?
Whatever makes people feel good. Like what I do is I spend money on clothes. I like to look good. I like designer fashion. I don't spend a lot of extra money, but when I do it, I spend it. I want to look good. That's what I do.
Fair enough. But I mean, if you're putting that on a credit card at 28%, that's a bad plan, right?
No, I mean, absolutely, it's a bad plan. And the book talks about credit cards. And really, the only purpose of a credit card is a convenient way to pay for things. You should never carry a balance on your credit card, ever.
The last conclusions of the book. So you talk about attitude. You first talk about attitude. Then you talk about balance. You walk us through debt stress, risk stress, and relief. Just give me a closing thought. I mean, what's the key to living a stress-free financial life, Jared?
You want to get to a point to where you never think about money. Never think about it. If people have too much debt stress, if they've taken out too much debt in the form of mortgages or car loans, they lay awake at night thinking about it. If they have too much risk in the stock market, they lay awake at night thinking about it. You want to get to a point where you're never thinking about money, because money stress compounds all other kinds of stress.
I will say this. We just got a copy of the book this week, and I haven't finished it yet, but I like it in my hand. It's a smaller size book. It's 200 pages. It's not a bulking thing. It reads very easily, and it's broken out into manageable, bite-sized chunks. There's no stress in reading this book, Jared. That's an accomplishment unto itself. Well done, sir.
That is a great compliment. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
No worries. How to live a stress-free financial life, says Jared Dillian. Just came out. All right, Jared, I'll review it more later, but thanks for your thoughts today.
Thank you.
More business news now on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Joanne is filing for bankruptcy after more than 80 years in business. The company has 35 locations in Illinois, including two in Chicago. Right now, those stores won't be affected. Joanne has 850 stores nationwide. Its website will also remain open. The fabric and craft retailer has secured $132 million in funding to help it reduce debt. Joanne has suffered from customers cutting back on discretionary spending due to inflation after its pandemic boom, when they tended to spend more money on arts and crafts while stuck at home. The bankruptcy filing listed liabilities of between $1 billion and $10 billion. Chicago-based Encyclopedia Britannica is preparing for an initial public offering that would value it at about $1 billion. The education technology company and book publisher is also the owner of the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Bloomberg says Encyclopedia Britannica may launch the IPO as soon as June. The company was founded 250 years ago and is the oldest English language general encyclopedia. Britannica's products get more than 7 billion page views annually and are used by more than 150 million students, according to its website. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of Food Time now with Steve Alexander.
Thank you, and get out the party horns and hats. It's National Agriculture Day in these United States, and I was in the grocery store the other day, and I saw something that made me say to myself,
wait a minute.
What it was, after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today, there's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, I was in the juice aisle and I noticed a stamp on a box of apple juice that said, a product of Turkey.
Wait a minute, no.
America has plenty of apples. So I sent an email to the juice company.
Thank you for doing that.
That voice is Mark Schilling. He's a fruit tree farmer in Southwest Michigan at Mick Klug Farm. He and his wife Abby grow a lot of apples and a lot of cherries too.
I'm on the Cherry Marketing Institute of Michigan. I'm on the Michigan Cherry Committee.
And Mark says it isn't only apples. Tart cherry concentrate is coming from Turkey, too. Again, America is number one in tart cherries. In fact, Michigan is
largest in the world.
So why is juice from Turkey on our store shelves?
Turkey has started producing large amounts of sweet and tart cherries.
Wait a minute. I see what's going on here.
What's going on in Turkey is that their government subsidizes the trees and the processing of the tart cherries in order to make it a commodity that they can trade with the European Union and the U.S. And how that affects us is it costs us $28 a gallon to produce tart cherry juice concentrate, where they can bring it in here for $6 a gallon.
Say that again.
It costs us $28 a gallon to produce tart cherry juice concentrate. Turkey can bring it in here for $6 a gallon.
Eesh. He says the tart cherry growers took Turkey to court.
Filed a dumping lawsuit. That lawsuit failed. in part because I don't think they have the appetite to politically go after Turkey for tart cherries.
So, as you're shopping for juice, be it apple or cherry,
keep an eye on those labels on the back to try to really support American-grown produce and American farmers.
On the food calendar, it's National Chocolate Caramel Day, and it's National Poultry Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
There's such a thing as tipping fatigue. How much should you tip? There's a story about this in the USA Today. Joining us now on the Wintrust Business Lunch is the lead editor at USA Today Blueprint, Robin Sachs Frankel. Hi, Robin. You're on the air. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. What's the average tip in America now?
Well, the average tip percentage in the U.S. right now is about 18%.
I saw in your story that the lead state is California at 23%. That maybe does not surprise me. I'm a little surprised by the state that tips the least at roughly 14%. Who is that?
That's you guys. Illinois residents tend to tip the least.
What's up with that?
But, you know, it does have the lowest tipping percentage of all the states, but in general, the Midwest and Southern states tend to tip lower than states on either coast.
Can you break it down demographically? I mean, what do we know about tippers? Who tips well, who tips not so well?
Sure. So younger adults tend to tip a little bit less. Let me pull up my statistics here. So let's see. Gen Z respondents and millennials who say they're tired of tipping, they tend to be some of the strongest tippers in the country. I apologize for that, even though they're the most frustrated. But they average about 18%, you know, not over tipping. Really, it's more about the time of year. Most Americans tend to tip more during the holidays, about 20%.
That does not surprise me. And frankly, it doesn't surprise me the younger people tip a little bit more, only because my observation is that people who tend to earn a little less live closer to their dollars, and they know how important that tip is to, say, a waitress or waiter, and so they tend to tip pretty well. You know who tips waiters and waitresses well? Waiters and waitresses. So
yes.
That seems to jive with me. And here's just another observation from your reporting, that as your education level increases, the average tip amount tends to go down. Associate degree, you tip 20%. Bachelor's degree, 19%. Graduate degree, 17%. Maybe those are the ones with all the student debt. Only doctoral degrees tick up a little bit at 18%. But that's kind of ironic, isn't it? The people that maybe have the most opportunity to make the most money there are tipping a little bit less.
Well, there's something to be said for the, you know, if you think about like the lifestyle of someone like a Warren Buffett, right? He could leave an $8 million tip on every meal if he wanted to. But generally, people who are wise with their finances, you know, they're wise with their finances because they're cautious in every single way for every single thing. So it's not necessarily that people who make more are necessarily cheapskates or out of touch with what it costs to live in some of these jobs that are very tip dependent to make up their salary. It also could be a function of how people choose to manage their money.
We are also getting tired of all of the opportunities to tip, aren't we?
Yes, it's gotten a little out of control. For example, if I go to like a coffee place and they just literally fill up a cup and hand it to me, and then when I go to swipe my card, they ask me if I want to add a tip. I mean, things like that are just a little bit surprising. You know, tipping used to be a little bit more specifically about the level of personal service, and now it just seems like tips are added in places where you didn't see them a generation ago.
I bought a beer at a ball game the other day. It was actually at the Blackhawks game. And the recommended tip when they flipped the screen around, it was preset to 20%. I was already paying a lot for that beer. No, it was at the Eagles concert. Doesn't matter. I was at the United Center for a show. But anyway, the preset tip was 20% for somebody that just handed me a beer. And to be honest with you, I thought, that's not the greatest job in the world. I did, though, opt for 18%. Little something for me, little something for you was my thinking on that, but it's tip fatigue. I understand that.
Right. I mean, 20% in general is supposed to be for exceptional service, right? I mean, there's no formal amount. I believe that most people kind of agree that 15% is kind of the baseline, and if your service is very subpar, you might choose to do less than that. And things, you know, service above that, you would tip a little bit higher. But a baked-in 20% automatic does seem a little bit extreme for counter service, for sure.
The beer was cold. Okay. How much to tip? Tipping statistics in the United States for 2024 is a story in the USA Today. I'm out of time today, but I recommend people check it out. Robin Sachs-Frankel, thanks for giving us your thoughts today.
Thanks for having me.